Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from Jupiter, Florida, in the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM, Sunday morning, January 24th, 2016. One can also hear this program live streaming. My guest this morning is businessman and author Gordon Zuckerman. Our subject is the importance of American manufacturing competitiveness. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. And we know that American manufacturing and business is, and how it works, is incredibly important to public policy in this country. Welcome back, Gordon, to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today. The last time we talked on the Advocates was just a bit over 2 years ago.
Thank you, and welcome back to the world of radio talk show. Your absence has, we've missed you. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Gordon Zuckerman is the author of the acclaimed historical fiction series, The Sentinels, and I believe his latest book, A Matter of Importance, from June 1963, and that's a long time ago. I remember that year quite well because I graduated high school, and it was a wonderful year. Following the author's graduation from Harvard Business School until close to 2005, when he sold his resort hotel company, Gordon Zuckerman enjoyed the privilege of working for 42 years as an entrepreneurial problem solver during what many people regard as the golden age of American commerce. Throughout this period, he was responsible for creating cattle feeding companies, student housing companies, a national joint venture, real estate investment company, REITs as we know them, and a resort hotel company. Becoming more familiar with the story behind the story, he believes the democratic free enterprise system represents the goose that lays the golden eggs and needs to be protected from those who abuse the privilege. He's used his writing easel to illustrate what can happen with a small fictional group, the Six Sentinels, and how they decide to make happen the constructive efforts and oppose those of questionable intentions. It's amazing that one can create such a world. I have such admiration for that. 2 years ago you joined and of course graced the Advocates, and we discussed your views on the economy. At that time you just finished your book, A Matter of Importance, in which you attempt to express the importance of reviving the manufacturing of consumer goods in America, and we all know what's happened to them. Just walk into Walmart and you'll find out. Gordon, as a man who's seen many trends regarding the American economic cycle, what's changed since we last talked?
Well, I'm more concerned about what hasn't changed. It took me about 2 years to do the research to where I was comfortable making certain statements about what I thought the true cost of either gaining or losing a manufacturing job in the United States might really be. And I became convinced at that time that when we started to encourage the offshoring of manufacturing, we didn't understand the true cost. So now that we do understand that for every dollar of wage that is either paid to or lost from the employment of a manufacturing worker, the government has additional loss of $2 in social costs and lost taxes, or if the job is reclaimed, receives an extra $2. Mm-hmm. And because of that inability to understand that, we have not, as both as a public and a government, not understood the true cost of losing manufacturing. And over the last few years, not only have we not recovered manufacturing jobs, we've lost more. And the effect of that is being clearly reflected in our economy.
Well, let's go back a little bit in time and get a little bit more in depth on this. It's been 7 years since President Obama took reins of the government. In the midst of the greatest meltdown of our economic machine since the Great Depression. Remember, in the Great Depression, right before the crash, 250,000 people worked for U.S. Steel, And by 1933, when FDR took over, one person worked for U.S. Steel. 2 years ago, we were both decently optimistic about the economic recovery, but as we both know, each recovery since World War II was stimulated by housing. This one seemed to be caused by housing. How do you see the recovery proceeding aside from housing? Give me your views on that.
Let me, Richard, let me go back a minute and take a little different tact at something you said. Clearly, when all the questionable credit began to surface in Wall Street and we got into all those defaults, real estate was a primary factor. There's no question about it. But my study has always led me to believe that what happened was is that when we started piling up a lot of real estate debt on top of consumer debt, excuse me, the total cost of debt was no longer a burden for the consumer that they could afford, and it was the unaffordability of the total debt that triggered the real estate thing. So what that told me was that the hidden costs of losing all those manufacturing jobs had been masked by the tremendous extension of consumer credit had finally bubbled to the surface, and the crisis in 2007-2008 was really a manifestation of that.
Well, but on the other hand, if you don't, you know, we had to flesh out, we had to literally get out of the system all these real estate defaults. And once that's done, I don't think that seems to be one of the problems. But let's look at what's come on since those days and see if there's any, bright light in the future. You know, we lost 9 million jobs in the 2007-2009 financial crisis. Critically speaking, 14 million jobs have been clawed back over the last 6 years of recovery. They're not going to be the high-paying jobs in the union factories of the Rust Belt. We know that at the moment. We seem not to be able to alter the systemic fault lines in our economic structure. Among one of the critical problems not addressed is the stagnation in real wages, which is connected to what you're saying. So with that in mind, are we exposed to another financial crisis, or is the only way we can get out of it have higher wages? How do you see this connection between higher wages and not being addicted to cheap foreign goods?
The bottom line is that wages have to increase as a result of growing demand for labor. And for the American economy to restore its manufacturing competitiveness, we have to find a way to reduce the cost of manufacturing in the United States so it can effectively compete in a global market for the total growing demand of consumer. So the question is, what is there in the United States that we can fix that will enable us to restore the competitiveness of American manufacturing? And my analysis, which is the basis for what I'm going to say, is that each time we add one manufacturing job to the economy, it creates the need for somewhere between 2 and 3 service jobs, so that with each job that's being created, 3 to 4 people are being removed from the ranks of the unemployed, and when you add up all the extra taxes they pay and all the social costs the government doesn't have to absorb, it's equivalent to $2 for every $1 the responsible employer pays the manufacturing worker. So if, since we are a nation of individual taxpayers, if we were to share with the responsible employer some of that incremental revenue that he is creating, we can reduce the effective cost of labor so that the American manufacturer can compete internationally for consumer good, for the, on the consumer goods market. That is the basic realization that it's a solvable problem that needs to take place.
Now, let me ask you to get a little bit deeper into this. You know, we're in a low inflation period, basically low inflation period. Of course, there's always budget creep. We understand that. And the critical question, as you've articulated, is how do you make ourselves more competitive? Now, we do have low energy costs that should have spilled back into companies saying, well, if I'm energy intensive, this is going to lower my margins. We have ample labor, and we have the increasing use of robotics, meaning that from any perspective, business may be more competitive here. Let's get away from the idea of taxes or anything on these businesses. But businesses can become more competitive. But how does that translate itself to the average worker who is being replaced, and maybe the future portends more robotics? How does robotics come into this, that it'll help American businesses, but will it help American labor?
Well, I think that you are raising probably the most important question that we need, as a nation, we need to face today. You know, because you hear the comments of your listeners, and I've had the benefit of, in other talk shows, of having direct exposure to your listeners, that there's been a tremendous loss of confidence in the trust of government, of companies, of most of the people, most of the situations you would need to retrain, recruit, and retrain are underemployed.
Mm.
So if the jobs can be created is one thing, but filling those jobs, we've got a tremendous challenge in terms of recreating the trust and confidence of our underemployed workforce.
Well, that seems to be the problem that is more of a 21st century problem than certainly post-war or somewhere in between the post-war and the crash of 2009. You know, each society, you know, one time we were very labor-intensive in rural areas. The farm had, up until the 1920s, had a huge percentage of our public live there. They don't live there anymore. The corporate farm can do with one person what 50 or 100, maybe even 1,000 could have done a generation before. So when we look at this situation, and the critical question is, how do you deal with what I would say is the new reality? The new reality is that you have these mega businesses that are hardly American corporations. They are interested in the bottom line. And this is exactly what Hedrick Smith talked about. This is what a number of people talk about. How do you get the business to say, we have to have well-paid workers and not worry as much about our shareholders? And Lewis Powell, you know, in my conversation of a couple of years ago, Justice Powell was one of the individuals who pushed big business to worry about the bottom line for the shareholders and not the workers. So how do we deal with this?
Well, I believe that the bottom line is that the American shareholder has to be convinced that we can more effectively service global markets by manufacturing in the United States, which means not only lower costs, but higher product quality, more reliability of supply, and so on. So until we solve the cost problem, we can't hope to encourage corporations to reconsider the venue of their manufacturing. So that's the problem that we have to go to war on. And I think that when we look back at the way we mobilized the American industrial arsenal for World War II, we have to make the same commitment in the year 2016. And the most important thing we realize is that it is a solvable problem.
Oh, I think we have a lot of solvable problems. I think we can solve education, healthcare, energy, and jobs. I think we can. These are not intractable problems that are violating the Newtonian law. I mean, they can be done. The question is, and I think we'll get into this a little bit later, the process and the use of the word planning. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But the bottom line is that, of course, before we go to a break, and I think this is in the next minute or so, can we reconcile the paradox of low interest rates needed to stimulate growth, and on the converse, the increase of credit card and borrowing because of lower rates without the commensurate investment in housing or the rolling stock of the country? It seems paradoxical, you know, that maybe the answer is that these lower rates aren't going to the right people. And what's your view on this, the idea that banks don't want to lend because they don't want to get into long, let's say, mortgages at unrealistically low rates? What's your thinking on that?
Well, I think you have to, once again, Richard, you're right on the money. I think you have to differentiate between financial borrowing or investment borrowing and productive borrowing. And when money is going into creating real assets that are required for producing jobs and so forth, the effect is one way. If you're just talking about making cheaper money available to buy stocks or invest in companies, you're artificially inflating the value of companies, and we've seen a lot of that.
No question.
The question is, what do we have to do to bring the trillions of dollars that are sitting offshore home? What do we have to do to redirect the lending or investment strategies of the American taxpayer to restore the productivity of our industrial arsenal?
That is
the central question.
Yeah,
I know I'm coming back to the same.
No, that's answer, you know
but,
that's
but,
that's
but
fine.
I think all roads
lead to Rome, as they say.
All roads lead from Mecca, and that
right.
Mecca is the reestablishing of millions of people who are earning, working in a dignified way for substantial wages, doing work that produces consumer goods that not only allow us to supply international markets, but allow us to introduce more consumptive income at the earned level.
Let me pay
more taxes.
We're going to get to this. Let me go to this break. Before we hear from a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates talking about business in America, sponsors with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP, 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida, January 24th, Sunday morning at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, author and serial entrepreneur, Gordon Zuckerman, and we're discussing the criticality of competitiveness in the American enterprise system. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest professor. I'll call him Professor Gordon Zuckerman. He's been on my program before, The Advocates, on WJUP 103.9 FM radio. Here we are on Sunday morning, 8 a.m., January 24th. We've been talking about one of his favorite subjects, the key to American capitalism and true competitiveness. And he's written about it. We've talked about it before, and we're going to continue to talk about it. Gordon, we have been discussing certain aspects of the American economy, and one of the most critical pieces of this engaging puzzle is American competitiveness, which is the essence of your thinking. Gordon, tell us how this has to be restored to create enough jobs to satiate the demand of our population, especially when young people need jobs coming out of school and older workers often cannot retire. Where is the lever? Is there should people be forced to retire? What's your thinking on this?
The answers are pretty obvious. In an economy that needs to produce about 2.5 million jobs a year, and we're only producing 1.5 million or less, so we're not able to produce 1 million jobs that are desperately needed a year. All you have to do is look at China and say, why in China's current planning have they anticipated adding 25 million jobs a year to their economy, and look at what they are doing to encourage manufacturers from all over the world to make it in China. They obviously have mined their cheap labor force. They burn dirty coal to produce, give them the opportunity to produce long-term, low-cost energy contracts. They provide inexpensive financing to allow companies to retool with the most modern, most efficient equipment. They offer relief from environmentalists and labor unions, and they offer relief from regulation. So the answers are there. So now you go back and you compare the United States. All right. Admittedly, we have to find a way to... And as I've stated, it's available to reduce the effective cost of labor.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has said that, and I don't think he's going to get much support from blue-collar, middle-class labor people if he ever gets the nomination.
Well, I'm not a great fan of Donald Trump. I think he's careless. I think he makes a lot of irrational statements, but I think he is truly talking to the anger and the disillusionment of the American people, and I'm beginning to wonder if it's a good idea for us to underestimate his influence. Anyway.
Yeah, go ahead.
To go on.
Yeah.
The point of it is that we have abundant sources of inexpensive labor, in particular of energy, particularly natural gas. So whether the coal industry cleans up its act or not, the energy is a solvable problem. We have the finest capital markets in America, and therefore, and most of, the, and as a matter of fact, which are financing most of the construction of offshore factories and things, which is another issue. I think labor unions can play a very important role, which I'll talk about. And environmental concerns are real, and increasingly industrial parks are being built out away from urban populations so that those problems can be eliminated. So I really believe that if you go back and work on the energy problem and on the employment, the cost of employment and recruiting problem, this issue becomes quite solvable. The biggest thing that's stopping us from achieving that is our belief that it's not solvable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thought that I think needs to be changed.
Well, my comments on that are twofold. I call it labor dislocation and education. A lot of people have talked about 5 million jobs in the United States that are going wanting. And I'm not talking about scut work per se. I don't think per se that you're south of the border illegal some people call them aliens, residents, are really taking American jobs. It's very possible that the overstaying visa jobs, you know, the people who have come on visas have taken some of these jobs too. But that's, I don't think that's the issue. I look at it as dislocation in education. How do you see solving the dislocation problem when people have lived in company towns for their whole lives, their generations, and they can't move, they can't sell their houses, they can't move, as we used to say, follow the sun to these places? And maybe, how do you train them? Do you have a new GI Bill?
Well, I think you're asking a couple of questions. The first question is relocation. For years, there's been a movement from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt. And the older people remain in their historical home, and young people are moving into the Sun Belt in search of better lives, better employment, whatever. So that's not new. So I don't know that the location of the work necessarily means a hell of a lot, although if you look at a city like Milwaukee, Detroit, Schenectady, and all these others that have really been killed with offshoring of jobs, there are a lot of reasons why companies should restore the employment in those areas, and I don't see any reason why it can't be done. So I don't think the location is the problem. I think the issue is the recruitment, the training, and the trust that's involved.
Mm.
And until we learn how to solve that, it's going to remain a very challenging problem. And I'm convinced, personally, that labor unions are not the source of the problem, but can be the source of the solution. And given the opportunity, I'd really like to, put this the way around. I have talked to some of my friends in the labor movement, and there is nobody more threatened by the offshoring of employment than labor officials, and more anxious to go back and see labor begin to fill its traditional role that it did in England of recruiting and training people for the manufacturer's employment needs.
Mm. Well, we're that's a very interesting juxtaposition because, of course, many of the jobs that have been created in the southern region of the country are right-to-work states, and obviously the many of these Midwestern and southern states are controlled by Republican governors and legislators, and they are anti-union, and they seem to have forgotten what you've said, that the competitive balance between capital and labor has to be maybe readjusted. And one of the senses, I think one of the great advances, the American buying power was the rise of labor after World War II. And this is something we're going to get into in the next segment. But the bottom line is this, and we still have to deal with it. How do you, and I think we should address this, how do you satiate the dissatisfaction of the white 50 to 60-year-old male who is not going to move, not going to be able to be relocated, not going to be able to re-educated for the newer economy? This seems to be the root of the dissatisfaction, taking the angst of these people and using it as a political tool, when everybody knows, I think, from the right and the left, that these people in the short run are going to be left out of the economic picture. And the question is, going forward, will it happen to the next generation? That's what we don't want to have. I think we have a lost generation of that group. You know, we're going to have another little break here and a word from our sponsors. This is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida, January 24th, Sunday morning at 8 a.m. I've been talking to My guest, author and serial entrepreneur Gordon Zuckerman. We've been discussing the criticality of competitiveness in the American enterprise system and how this can be adjudicated. How, not maybe for today and tomorrow, but down the line. We're not going to go away in 2 years from what we have. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Advocates, and my guest, Gordon Zuckerman. You're on WJUP 103.9 FM with The Advocates. It's Sunday morning, January 24th. We've been talking to Gordon Zuckerman again and his vision to revise American capitalism through true competitiveness. Gordon, some economists realize the problem of the United States becoming competitive cost producer. With that in mind, the heart of our problem is not jobs per se, but good-paying jobs. With increasing wages to keep up with inflation, potential, and a more secure future. Gordon, you've said that you don't think that labor unions are the heart of the problem, and I don't either. How can the United States become a competitive cost producer, giving these high wage levels that unions demand?
Well, the solution that I envision doesn't necessitate the compromising of the wages paid to the worker.
Mm.
What it envisions is that the government will share the incremental revenue that is created by that new employment with the person who creates the employment to reduce his effective cost.
Yeah.
Of employment, and therefore, we're not trying to reconstruct the economy of the United States on the backs of the worker, but we're trying to help the government to understand that there are other ways to help our manufacturers to be competitive, other than offshoring of jobs. So that's a critical education problem that has to occur with the public. And has to occur with the government.
Mm.
Now, where I think the labor unions come in is that there's an enormous problem of trust that has to be resolved.
Mm.
And if you think about the roots of the American labor industry in this country, it came in because the American worker needed to be protected.
Mm.
And so it started off in terms of working conditions, labor costs, fringe benefits, all these things that were required to help the American worker enjoy a better life.
Get more leverage, let's say it. Well, then, you know, the
guilt. So yeah. I'm saying that later on when the labor unions became more concerned about increasing the manufacturer's costs and making him less competitive, maybe their efforts weren't as constructive as in the eyes of the employer as they might have been earlier.
Mm.
So I just think we have new conditions, new situations that require trust, and the labor unions can, there's a really important opportunity.
Well,
for the labor unions to reestablish themselves.
I'm reminded of my son at Princeton many years ago when he put this online newspaper, if you want to call it, called The Spigot. And the idea was to have it not too hot and not too cold, you know, regarding the economy. Now, here, we're dealing with something that we hear from Bernie Sanders, you know, all talk of, some people would say utopianism, some people would talk about not being realistic. Planning has always been a dirty word spoken by politicians and economists. They usually get accused of being leftist or the promulgator of more of the nanny state. We last experienced this, of course, when necessity was the mother of invention with the war mobilization that started in 1940 and became incredibly accelerated after Pearl Harbor. Can that be done today? this concept of planning, that you can get people to buy into planning like the Dutch do and the Germans do on wind power. Okay. Can this be done, and what will it take?
Well, the answer is you can't just push a button and it's going to happen.
Right.
I think it starts with the realization, and this, if there's a point to my comments, is that we as a country have to become aware of the fact that we have a very, very serious and potentially dangerous problem on our hands, and that as a nation we have to focus on that the same way we would focus if we were being threatened by some foreign military. So I think it starts with an awareness and a commitment of people to solve the problem, so that when you get to the congressional level or wherever you want to go, the people, if they want to get reelected, have to understand that they're going to demonstrate to the people why they're helping solve the problem. And they're not necessarily implementing policies that have been introduced by their significant campaign contributors. So I think the reason I like to use the word lighting the candle is that I think the time is now that we have to begin to light the candle of public opinion. And that's why programs like yours are so valuable, is that it allows people to hear a different voice than the one that is being encapsulated in the sound bites of television and the headlines of newspapers. And it's ultimately going to be the people of the United States saying it's time for us to take back our country and declare war on global manufacturing competitiveness. Once that occurs, and once the political process is forced to be reflective of that, then I think that the problems that we're talking about today become quite solvable.
Well, you know, you made a very interesting allusion to going to war on this. A lot of people probably have forgotten that in FDR's first inaugural, of course, they remember the statement, there's nothing to fear but fear itself, but in that inaugural, he made allusions constantly to a war, constantly to military allusions, constantly to it. And that's very interesting that you brought that up. But getting back to what came out of the New Deal in the post-war era was the GI Bill, which was, in a sense, the greatest educational effort as a partnership with government that we've had. Is that what we need to re-educate, almost like a GI Bill for workers, in a sense? Get these workers on the path where corporations and labor can be in synergy. How do you see that?
Well, I think absolutely. There are different forms of that that need to be addressed. But I believe that, well, first of all, I believe that public service is important. And I don't know why we don't expand our public service to include other things beyond military, so that people can earn the benefit of that is assistance on education, and we should have a modern version of the GI Bill, absolutely. But I'm still convinced that when we look at our community college system, which is basically, I mean, to call it a vocational training system is way over, not fair.
No, it's high school plus.
Yeah, but there in most communities, there is a lot of very valuable vocational training that has taken place. And I think we have to put emphasis on vocational training as well as intellectual
education. No question.
Education.
Well, go ahead.
And we got to go to work on that.
Yeah.
So why can't, I'll go back to my labor union thing, to make sure that the right educational processes are being provided that are needed by the employer, and the employer's need for properly trained people is being fulfilled, why can't the labor unions bridge that gap?
Yeah. Well, you know, That's a good, interesting question. And remember, we went through a long period of time where there became imposed a stigmata on vocational education. We have to get away from that stigmata, get away from that demeaning of that class. We need plumbers, we need masons, we need we need people who can do these jobs, and there shouldn't be a stigmata about them. You know,
but I'm talking about more than your traditional trades. I'm talking about the sophisticated electronic computer training, all the things that go into fulfilling the job description of the American manufacturer employment.
Well, before we go, Lou, we have to go to a break, but you're 100% right. Nobody needs $150,000, $160,000 education from a liberal arts college to become a Latin studies major and not be capable of balancing a checkbook. You know, before we go to our last segment and hear from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP, 103.9 FM in Jupiter, Florida, January 24th, Sunday morning at 8 a.m. I've been talking to my guest, author, entrepreneur Gordon Zuckerman. We're discussing the criticality of creating more competitiveness in the American enterprise system. This is going to be very, very important to the future. We'll be back in a second or so. Welcome back to our last segment of The Advocates with my guest, Gordon Zuckerman. This is WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter. We've been talking about his thoughts on American capitalism, true competitiveness, and where we're going. You know, the criticality of spreading this message is taking back the argument from the folks that dance around this issue and trivialize the process, especially in Washington. As I mentioned earlier, I interviewed Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, journalist, producer, who wrote Who Stole the American Dream. His thoughts are very much in line with yours, but he stresses the inherent inequities in our system. Gordon, tell our audience how you are getting across your message. How do you reach people?
Well, I have, as you know, as an author, each time I publish a book, work with different talk show hosts around the country, and on any given time I work with 40 or 50 of them and reach their audiences, and I really treasure that, and I make the time necessary to do that because of how much value I place on my opportunity to interface with your listeners and learn from them how they are looking at problems, and that gives me a great opportunity to think about how I want to approach a problem.
Mm.
Now, I am reminded of conversations that I've had with you in New York. I've had conversations in Milwaukee, Detroit, Schenectady, and I've found the talk show host to really be current on what's going on and concerned, as are their listeners.
Mm.
And how can you not be sympathetic to somebody who's done everything right, educated their children, worked in a General Motors factory, gone to church, everything you could ask of an individual, they've done right, only to find out that for situations well beyond their control, that their jobs have been eliminated.
Mm.
Their anger, their frustration, their disillusionment is real. And so what I'm saying is I'm not buying the argument that 50-year-old people can't be retrained,
mm,
or you can't appeal to their pride or restore their attitudes about the dignity of work. I think that's challengeable.
Mm.
So
go ahead.
What I'm saying is, let's go to work.
Yeah. You know, there's been a percentage of Americans who read and read critically. They used to not only be the influence makers, but the people who influenced the movers and shakers. Today, we see less readers among the most productive people in our society. They get the news on the internet, often on their phone. They read books associated with their work. They have less and less leisure time for introspective thought. How do you reach these folks, you know, this new generation of financial managers, entrepreneurs, people who run all over the country and are the doers, let's say, for one description of them? How do you reach these folks? And if you could, and if you did, would it make a difference?
I had to make, in my personal case, I had to make a decision a long time ago. Did I want to write commercially successful, high-volume, one-dimensional thrillers, or did I want to be associated with work that thoughtful people would like to discuss with me?
Mm-hmm.
So what I've decided to do is to circumvent the traditional publishing industry and write for the community of readers who are interested in thinking about these issues more, and do whatever I can to each year expand my readership, and that is kind of my contribution to
right.
helping, repay all of the fortunate experiences that I've been allowed to benefit from.
It's like a circle of influence,
building
on to the circle, expanding it through ripple effects, getting more people to talk. And in my view, people are talking at each other, not to each other. And I think I think one of the problems of Washington and many of the state capitals is pretty profoundly simple, that there's been a curse done on the centrists, the people who want to reach, go forward. People have thought, well, the centrists are just kicking the can down the road and they're really not achieving, you know, systemic change. I don't think that's true, really. I think you got to... Rome wasn't built in a day. You got to crawl before you walk. You got to have people getting together and say, here's our problem: healthcare, education, jobs, climate, water resources. That's going to be one of the great problems going forward in the world, no question. Before we close, and we can kick this around forever, we're in the midst of a very vibrant and contentious political season. What else is new? I ask this question of everyone, and I'm not going to ask you who you're going to support, but maybe your crystal ball. A quick question: who's going to be the nominee of each party? You have any opinion on that, or you're going to keep your powder dry?
No, I have a very strong opinion.
Okay.
And it's based on the fact that I believe that ultimately the American electorate is more concerned, more aware, more fearful of a variety, a handful of problems that, if they're not well attended, could really change the way of life as we have known it.
Mm.
And I think they're listening. I think they're going to be listening.
So who do you think? Just as a guess, they're not going to hold your feet to the fire 6 months from now.
Well, I think it's going to be the person who offers the best solution.
Okay.
Problem. And I don't think that person has emerged yet.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you want to talk about leadership? Let's talk about creative problem solving.
Yeah, well, we only have...
When they get down to specifics, rather than talking about platitudes about how to appeal to people emotionally, I want to know how they're going to solve the problem.
Yeah, well, to me, I've given my opinion before, I'm pretty sure.
Have I ducked your question?
No, that's all right. Everybody does. I would say this, I would bet you the kitchen sink on Hillary, and I got a feeling it's going to be Romney who's going to come out of the convention. I may be crazy on that. You know, but with all that in mind, Gordon, thanks for joining me once again. Good luck with your book. I know you've got another one, Voices Behind the Curtain. I think that'll be successful, and your message is important. Thank you for joining me again today. It's always a pleasure hearing from your perspective, your views.
thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back.
Thank you. Great to hear. And always, you know, we're going to talk later in the year, you know, when maybe some of these situations flesh out and see whether you're satisfied with what people are talking about. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where all my information on my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Nick Taylor, author of the great book on WPA, and we're going to talk about presidential criticism and the political mess we seem to be in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for Gordon Zuckerman for being on my program. Same time next week, we'll talk about another subject. Thank you. Bye-bye.